to The Rescue Radio, the show that brings you closer to the outdoors. My name is Anya Viktorovich, and I'm extremely happy to have you all here. Today, we are going to talk about a crevasse rescue on Denali. And with me here today, I have Chris Erickson, who is also a park ranger. Hi, Chris.
How's it going?
Good. Chris, can you tell us something about yourself?
Well, as you just mentioned, I'm a park ranger. I've been so for about 16 years or so. I spent 14 years on Denali as a mountaineering ranger. By the time I left, I was the lead mountaineering ranger. Spent many, many seasons and years climbing up there personally, but then also professionally. And then about a year and a half ago, I transitioned down to Olympic National Park, which is where I live and work now in Northwest Washington.
Beautiful area. I love climbing there. Thanks, Chris. So could you tell us where it was and maybe briefly describe the route, how difficult it is, and maybe the conditions?
So this particular accident happened on the West Buttress climbing route of Denali. That is by far the most popular climbing route on Denali. The West Buttress has a fairly easy reputation when it comes to mountaineering routes. For instance, there are no mandatory rock or ice pitches that you have to climb. It's mostly walking in snow. There are some spots that are steeper. People fall, people get into trouble, you know, fairly regularly. The crevasse rescues tend to happen lower on the mountain. So on the upper half of the mountain, people tend to fall, like a mountaineering fall. And the lower half of the mountain, they tend to get in trouble in crevasses. So this happened on the Kehiltnik Glacier at just below 8,000 feet, probably at about 7,700 feet, right on the main route, right in the middle of the main part of the climbing season. I believe it was the first week of June, you know, right, probably one of the busiest days on the mountain for that entire year.
And that was about 5 or 6 years ago, you said?
Yes, I believe it was 2017, if I'm remembering correctly. So this would have been, 6 years ago, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. And then conditions?
Well, the conditions were overall fairly good for that time of year. Judging the crevasse hazard on Denali, it's a little bit different than the crevasse hazard in the lower 48. The crevasse hazards in the lower 48 tend to be a little bit more predictable in kind of a seasonal style. So in winter, crevasses are covered over, and in summer, they're melted out. And so they gradually melt out, you know, in the spring. That would be typical lower 48. And for a lot of Alaska, that's exactly the same. What can be a little bit different, though, is that on certain parts of Denali, it's so cold all winter, it really doesn't snow. And then in the summertime, it warms up and snows. And so there are places on Denali where the coverage is better in the summer than it is in the winter.
Interesting.
For the lower Kehiltnik Glacier, it's a little bit more of a traditional snows in the winter. It's warm in the summer. When we get snowstorms in June, low elevation snowstorms, those tend to be accompanied by wind. And that often results in many people falling into crevasses shortly after that. When you get the sagging bridges and when you get open, unstable snow bridges, then they get covered up, maybe, you know, 6 inches, 8 inches of snow plus wind. That's when people tend to fall in.
Right.
The West Buttress route itself kind of gets compacted by so many people walking on it throughout the year. And so sometimes those bridges artificially hang on a little longer than they should. The conditions on this particular day, I would say they were fairly unremarkable, as at least my memory. It was not particularly warm, not particularly cold, not particularly snowy, not particularly windy, just a fairly typical day for the West Buttress in the first week of June.
Okay. So tell us what happened. Let's jump in.
Yeah. So there was a team that was descending the mountain. They were done with their trip. Mm-hmm. And they left together out of 14,000 feet to go back down to base camp, which is just about 7. The group itself had a mix of skiers and snowshoers, and the skiers very quickly got ahead. If I remember correctly, I think there were 5 skiers, 2 snowshoers. Skiers very quickly got ahead and just continued down the mountain without the rest of the team. The 2 snowshoers lagged behind a little bit and then essentially kind of formed their own team of 2. They were not traveling roped. They came through 7,800 feet, and at around midnight, could have been more like 11, 1130, something like that. But, nighttime, which of course, first week of June is not really night. You don't even need a headlamp to travel that time of the year. It's still very bright out, but it's one of the colder times of the day. This team of 2 traveling unroped went through 7,800 foot camp. They kept descending. And then just outside of camp, maybe a couple hundred yards outside of camp, one of the 2 snowshoers, he was dragging a sled. He had a backpack on, snowshoes on. He plunged through the compacted bridge into a crevasse. Mm-hmm. The crevasse at the top was maybe 4 feet wide or so, and then almost engineered, like every foot that you went down, it got about a half inch narrower. So shaped like a very tall letter V. And so this climber fell in. Because he fell unroped, he fell in with a very high speed, a high velocity when he went in. Partner saw him or you know, all of a sudden saw that he wasn't there and saw that he was missing. So it was, you know, someone was there right away. He fell approximately 60 feet down into the crevasse, but didn't stop because he had hit the bottom. He stopped because he had become wedged between the two walls, which had become progressively closer and closer and closer together as you go down. His partner immediately realized that he couldn't help him, backtracked into Camp 1, which is at 7,800 feet, and started calling for help. There were, I believe, 4 mountain guides, could have been more, that responded right off the bat. Several from Mountain Trip, including one of the owners, Bill Allen, and then also Aaron Lane and Carl Welcher, and then a guide named Christy Kale with the, she is with the American Alpine Ascents. They all responded and spent, you know, they called us right away, of course, to try to get some additional assistance. And then they responded for several hours, and I think about 3 hours or so, lowering people in, trying to get this climber out, but were unsuccessful. They were unsuccessful for a lot of similar reasons that I was unsuccessful for a long time as well, which I'll get into those in just a minute. Mm-hmm. At the time of the call, Frank Preston, one of the other mountaineering rangers, and myself, we were already in the SAR room. We had another patient with appendicitis that we were trying to get in to evacuate at that time. That patient was, you know, several hundred or maybe 1,000 feet below this crevasse wall. So we were already in, we were already geared up, we were kind of already ready to go, but the weather was not very good in between Talkeetna and the mountain. And so we sat there for a couple of hours waiting for clouds to clear up enough to be able to fly in our contract helicopter. At about 4 a.m., maybe just a little bit earlier, 3:30, something like that, we were able to kind of poke our way through in the helicopter. Clouds were still pretty tenuous, but you know, we were able to get through, flew in and dropped Frank and I off at this scene. And so at that point, drop off, leave, pick up that other appendicitis patient. The helicopter then returned back to Talkeetna and we got to work. We communicated with the guides. They're all folks that we know fairly well. The rangers and the guides work pretty closely together on the mountain. And in fact, I think I had worked other rescues with almost every one of these other guides at some other point as well. Knew who they all were. They immediately pitched a pretty grim scenario of what was going on down there. It was that the crevasse was extremely narrow. And we knew that via radio traffic. They were saying like, you know, hey, kind of bring what you have, specialty tools, kind of those out of the box ideas. Like if you have them, bring them, because traditional crevasse rescue techniques may or may not work for this. Mm-hmm. This is not a simple lower hookup raise.
Mm-hmm. Was the patient conscious?
The person was conscious. Yeah. We were able to communicate. English was their second or, I don't know, third or fourth language. Limited communication, but we were able to communicate. Okay. It was not overly productive communication. This person was in a pretty tight spot, but we were able to communicate. Mm-hmm. The person eventually did lose consciousness after about 12 hours or so of rescue efforts. But I guess I'll get to that in a little bit. So I communicated with the guides. We had a briefing up top, kind of talked about the hazards, and then they lowered me in to the crevasse. And I immediately realized what they had already known, which was that it was hopelessly narrow down in the crack. So I got lowered down to the point where, you know, I'm going to say maybe like 20 or so feet down, something like that. You know, I kind of had to pick which way my feet were going to go. Like if I pointed them to the right, I could no longer turn them to the left. If I pointed them straight out from each other, like a starfish, then I could no longer turn them anymore. So I'm kind of looking down like, all right, let's make that call. Maybe go another 10 feet or something like that. And I had to make the same choice with my head and with my helmet. I was, you know, wearing a helmet going down in, and then clearly the crevasse was narrower than the length of my helmet. Mm. So I kind of had to make that call like, okay, so now I'm kind of getting lowered in. I can't turn my head, can't turn my feet. I've got my hands sort of splayed out to the side. And I got lowered to the point where I got stuck. And when I got stuck, it was very difficult for me to communicate with the top. I already knew that I was going to have to take my radio off, you know, to have any chance of getting down there. So I'd taken my radio off. So I'm yelling up, you know, like, stop, stop, like trying to get them to stop lowering. But of course, they can't really hear me all that well. It's pretty far down and the crevasse kind of arced in just a little bit to where you couldn't really see the top from the bottom. You know, now the rope is piling up at my chest. Like the rope is slack now. What's holding me up is my chest cavity, essentially. And every time I took a breath, I would sink a little bit further down in every time I exhaled. So I'd kind of like, then I'd like try to stop breathing. Now I'm kind of trying to like shimmy myself to where I can, yeah. I'm not lowering anymore. Now I'm very quickly kind of running out of breath. Eventually, Frank, my coworker, kind of looked over the edge, saw what was going on, called up rope, had me, you know, they hauled me up to the top, pulled Frank aside and said, like, look, this is super grim. We're going to have to come up with a different way to communicate there. And so Frank basically clipped himself in as an edge attendant. And then I don't think he moved for about 13 hours, 12 hours or something like that after that. So I tried it again. This time I lowered myself, or I got rid of all my jackets, got rid of my shell pants, got rid of my helmet, got rid of every possible thing that I could in order to make myself narrower. Got lowered in, got to the same point to where my chest was constricted, couldn't really breathe, couldn't really talk anymore. Had them go up rope, maybe 4 inches or something like that. And at that point, I think I was about 10 or maybe 15 feet above the patient. So because he fell in unroped and with a very high speed and velocity, he just went a lot further than I was able to go. And so when I'm looking down and below me, you know, every foot that this crevasse goes down, it gets narrower and narrower and narrower. And so I kind of look down like, this is completely hopeless. Like there is no chance this is going to end well. There's a story from the early 80s, if I'm not mistaken, maybe it was late 70s, about a crevasse rescue that did not end well. Someone basically just either had hypothermia or eventually died when their partner could not get them out. That's a story that I don't know the details off the top of my head right now, but we're all pretty aware of that on the staff, of this kind of pinned, unable to extravate crevasse scenario. It's one that at that point I'd spent basically 10 years mentally preparing for, like, okay, what am I going to do in that particular case? And then of course, as I kind of hung there on the end of the rope looking down, I was like,
this is it.
I really don't know. Yep. I have not exactly sure what the plan is here. So raise back up to the top. And then at that point, the guides kind of keen to pull out, go back to their clients. You know, they had all just left to come down here. They've been up all night. We replaced them essentially with a couple more rangers. So my coworker, Dan Korn, two patrol members, they're volunteers who were on patrol with him, both came and, all three of them were flown in and were dropped off at our location. So we had our team of five, Justin and Stefan. Were the other two. So at that point, we kind of made the decision, okay, we brought in some specialty tools. Let's see what we got here. And so we took inventory. One of the things that we brought was this really bizarre looking metal hook that none of us were really exactly sure what it was for, but I'd seen it around our shop for like, you know, the past decade or something like that. It's like, well, let's just grab that. Maybe we can get in underneath them and pull them up like a fish, you know? So we tried that. Of course, that didn't work. We brought a chainsaw and attempted to chainsaw him out. And that did not work very well at all. There were a handful of problems. First of all, like, you know, we didn't have the choke or throttle adjusted for altitude. Justin Fraser was able to fix that. Eventually, we finally got it running. But once we got it running, you know, I got lowered in. Now, of course, I've got the chainsaw. I'm holding it with one hand. And I can't, once it's in one hand, I can't put it in the other hand.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to operate this. I don't know if it was like a 24-inch chainsaw or something like that, one-handed. And the thing's bucking up. Every time I like contact the ice, it's bucking up towards my tensioned rope. You know, and I'm just thinking like, I don't know how this is going to go. But one thing I'm sure of is that I'm not going to cut my own rope down here trying to get this guy out. We tried that for a while. That did not work. Went back up to the top. Then we're thinking, okay, we'll use a chainsaw like an elevator shaft. You know, we'll just come in from the top. Tried that. It was super slow going. We hit a layer of ash from an old volcanic eruption. Mm-hmm. And that really quickly dulled the blades. And then it just wouldn't work after that. I was kind of gauging the progress of this elevator shaft idea and decided like, no. This is like a week-long project probably to try to do this. So that was out. We brought in this like little flamethrower type thing, thinking we could melt the ice around him. That was problematic. It didn't really work all that well. None of the specialty tools that we brought with us seemed like even remotely close to having a chance of working. And so eventually they lowered me back in and all I had was an ice axe and an ice axe with an adz on the back of it and lowered me in and just started chipping. And, you know, I think I hit my leg more times than I hit the ice. Those first couple of stints in there, you get lowered. You have no purchase. You know, you can't really swing. You're not taking a big swing. It's like Shawshank Redemption. You know, it's like one little pebble at a time. Might spend 20, 30 minutes chipping out a piece of ice the size of like a dinner plate or something like that. Super painfully slow. Also, you know, we couldn't go down right on top of him. We had to go down next to him. Otherwise, we were just going to bury him in chipped ice. And that eventually almost started to happen. We actually, so we did this for like 10 or 11 or 12 hours or something. We're just taking rotations. People would come through. They'd spend an hour down in the hole, come back out. Another person would go in for an hour. It was only big enough for one person at a time. So extremely slow, world's most boring video. If you could have filmed it, little to no progress is what it felt like. Felt pretty hopeless. So we're kind of coming down next to the guy, but progress nonetheless. We're able to get a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit here, a little bit there. And so all of the folks that I've mentioned all took a turn. Jake Barron came through. He took a turn. He's a guide for RMI who ended up joining our crew, I believe, in the next year. We all kind of took a handful of turns. You know, an hour was a really long time to be that confined and in that place. So that was generally speaking about the cutoff. And then after about, I don't know, 10 hours or 11 hours or something like that, the weather cleared just enough to get the helicopter back in with a couple more coworkers, some replacement people, basically. And they came in with a pneumatic air chisel also. And a pneumatic air chisel is this, basically the size of a drill, like a cordless drill, but has the function of a jackhammer. And we had excavated enough ice at that point to be able to turn that pneumatic air chisel perpendicular to the ice wall. And then we started making actual real progress. Once that came in, then things kind of felt like they were going to be a little bit better. We still were having to lower boiling water down to the person on the end of the line to then dump on the ice chips to melt them because we had nowhere for those ice chips to go. Then of course, you couldn't get both of your hands together. So they had to lower the boiling water with the cap off. And I don't know how many times I had boiling water just spilled straight all over me, but it was more than a couple. But melt the ice chips, use the pneumatic air chisel. And then finally, as like a little bit of a breakthrough moment, we got this space big enough so that two people could work down there. And at this point, we're like in contact with this guy. I should back up a little bit. I forgot one maybe significant part. This happened like halfway through or so. We finally had gotten to his backpack or something. We didn't know what it was, but there was like, okay, we clipped a strap. We thought it was a harness. Is it a backpack? We're not quite sure. Mm-hmm. And we just decided to pull until something broke, whatever that was. Like pull as hard. So we had like, I don't know, 6-8 people up on the surface. I want to say we're pulling on a 9-to-1 and like heave-ho, all the things you're not supposed to do in crevasse rescue. Of course, this guy's pack just like rocket launches up. We pulled his pack and broke his pack straps off of him trying to get him out at that point. And he was so wedged. Now kind of go back and he had been talking or kind of more yelling to us the entire time. And we had a pretty good idea from his description that it was he had snowshoes on and his snowshoes were what was keeping him in the crevasse, that they were hopelessly pinned and cammed down in the, again, still not the bottom of the crevasse. The crevasse went hundreds of more feet, but it just kind of pinched off narrow enough to kind of feel like the bottom. So he kept yelling, snowshoes, snowshoes, snowshoes. Every time we pulled, snowshoes, snowshoes. You know, we got to him, got to his harness, a couple more hours. We eventually get down to his feet. He's lost consciousness by this point and has been unconscious for, I'm going to say, 3 or 4 hours by the time we're finally getting down to his snowshoes. He did show like sort of this incredibly random, like kind of sporadic sign of life where right in the middle, he hasn't made a noise, has not moved in hours. And all of a sudden he just picks up his head, opens his eyes, looks around and then closes his eyes again. Like, okay, hey, this guy's still alive. You know, but no detectable pulse, no detectable respirations. Not that we could really feel all that well down on the bottom. Anyway, we finally get down to his last snowshoe. I don't think I'll ever forget the frustration involved with trying to get his last snowshoe strap. I think it took me about 25 minutes to cut his last snowshoe strap free from him. And that was with like an incredibly sharp knife. And I just could not position the knife in a way to get enough leverage to cut that snowshoe strap. So it took forever. But finally, after cutting that last snowshoe strap, he sprang upwards just a little bit from tension in the rope that we had attached to him. And so that was it. We thought, this guy's free. You know, we're going to be able to get him out of here. Hauled him up to the surface, kind of some super heinous, like overhead hazard for rescuers at that point. Like we had to stop and kind of reconfigure him. And, you know, we were just getting shelled. Of course, we have no helmets or anything down in there because we're trying to get as small as possible, but finally get him up and over the lip. You know, at that point, kind of felt a little like Formula One pit crew style, like clothes off, warm sleeping bag with chemical warming blankets ready for him. Helicopter came within a couple of minutes, something like that. Picked me up, picked a medic up, and picked the patient up. Loaded him into the helicopter and flew. And we couldn't go to our normal area, which would be the Matsu Hospital for that type of patient. Weather was still bad to the south, so we had to fly to Fairbanks, which was about twice the flight time. You know, of course, during that time, we ran out of oxygen on him, landed at the hospital. We were able to get him to the emergency room, still kind of evidently alive, almost no signs of life, but we had a very faint respiration. So we were able to detect at that point, dropped him off. And I'm kind of thinking like, well, you know, I don't really think this guy's going to make it, but able to get him out, which I later interviewed everyone who went down into the crevasse and just said like, hey, when you first saw it, what percentage chance did you give this guy of making it out? And generally speaking, the answers were 0 or 1. Most of the people that were looking at this were thinking this is not a survivable situation, or yeah, I give him 1% chance. Pretty low numbers. Got him there, got him to the ER. You know, I think I kind of later heard some very significantly low body temperatures for this particular person. Dive too much into like HIPAA stuff, but exceptionally low body temperatures. And, you know, more or less, he was just kind of dealing with hypothermia. He had very few other injuries. He was in the ICU for a while. He ended up kind of going back home under medical care, and to my knowledge, made a full recovery.
That's amazing. I mean, he won a lottery.
A very lucky day on a very unlucky day.
Yeah. Wow, what a story. Almost, it's like you should make a movie about it. So how many hours altogether did it take? Because you said first the guides and then you guys. It seems like a long time stuck in a crevasse.
I think it was about 15 maybe or so. So 15 or 16, I think, from the time of his fall to the time he was extricated, or to the time he's in definitive care. Honestly, I lose track of it. I was pretty tired by the end of it. I bet I can look at the numbers, but I think the whole ordeal was around 16 hours.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, to not die out of hypothermia, it's really a miracle. That's great. So, Chris, what I always like to do is talk about things that could go better. And so perhaps if you could talk about how prepared the person was and what he could have done better.
Yeah, I'll do my best to represent
his. Comes to mind right now.
Yeah, there's two big factors. One of those factors is the kind of the ranger opinion as to how this could have been prevented. The other one was the patient's opinion as to how it could have been prevented. And I think maybe just on this patient's behalf, you know, I'll give his as well. This doesn't happen if you're roped. A crevasse fall can happen. Injuries can happen. A significant crevasse fall can happen. But falling to the point where you become wedged from that high-speed fall does not happen when you're roped. Now, if you weigh 400 pounds and your partner weighs 50 pounds, sure. Maybe now you have a different problem to solve, or two people in the crevasse or something like that. But even an empty rope, like the friction from an empty rope, can potentially slow you down, which, you know, that lack of force may have saved hours in this particular case. And so the big one is roping up. It's kind of a cultural thing sometimes. We see folks whose primary experience is in the Alps that they generally or often do not rope up on the Kahilna Glacier. Folks who have learned in the Pacific Northwest or in the U.S. tend to rope up. So, you know, ropes, I don't want to say they're a controversial topic. They're a very useful tool. I travel roped all the time, every single time on the West Buttress, will continue to do so. So that's a big one. Second one was the method of travel. This person really believed that they fell because they were on snowshoes, not skis. And I think when you look at the, you know, likelihood of going into a crevasse, it feels for sure like it is higher if you are wearing snowshoes. That said, I'm aware of several skiers going into crevasses also. And we had there was a fatality maybe just 2 years ago of a skier that went into a crevasse unroped, not on Denali, but within Denali National Park in one of the backcountry areas. Later that year, if I'm not mistaken, it was about 3 weeks later, we had a skier go in to a crevasse and fell the distance. So it is less likely on skis, but not impossible on skis versus snowshoes. One thing for sure is that if you are not a skier, your likelihood of a knee injury or something like that is extremely high. So it's not like skis solve the problem. You still have to know how to use them. And we watch really good skiers get into trouble every single year. So I think in terms of the preparedness, you know, this was a competent climber, someone who knew what they were doing and knew the hazards that they were facing, but chose to travel unroped. And I would say that that's the biggest single determination point for how they got so stuck.
Did he have a harness on? Because you mentioned
he did have a harness on.
You did. Okay.
Yeah, so they had a harness on. They had traveled various sections of the route roped. But most people, when they get down to the Kill in the glacier, you know, it's big, broad glacier. And again, most of those types of glaciers in the Alps or in the Andes or somewhere else, there's just a little bit less of a crevasse fall hazard.
And what do you think went well?
Well, yeah, boy. Well, let's see. Maybe a couple handful of things to highlight. Big one is going to be the working relationship of the professionals on the mountain. So the guides and the rangers really in this particular case worked in tandem, hand in hand. You know, you couldn't tell who was who while we were working together. That is a relationship that is forged by good, close working conditions and working relationships over years. Most of the folks I was working with are folks I've known for a long time. We speak the same language. I have a certain measure of understanding of what it means when they're setting up a particular system, and they know the same of me. Mm-hmm. So that was a really good one. I think as well, take the total amount of persistence involved in the rescuers and then divide it evenly by the folks that were there. And that's going to be something that went very well as well. Just the amount of time spent, you know, trying to get this person out.
That is an incredible story, Chris. Thank you for sharing. Is there anything else you would like to add to our listeners?
There's a saying that floats around Denali sometimes, and that saying is that worse climbers than you have summited this mountain, and better climbers than you have died on this mountain. And ultimately, it doesn't matter how good you are or how experienced you are. What matters is the decisions that you make. And so to be prepared to want to try to get to the top, but be willing to turn around, be willing to rope up, be willing to make the safer decision. That's really what gets people home at the end of the day. And so I think for a big mountain, especially when you're on your way down, it can be kind of easy just to sort of smell the barn and smell the hamburger at the end of the tunnel and let your guard down. But the real challenge is to make those safe decisions, you know, for 3 straight weeks, not letting your guard down, even for the final couple hours.
That's a really good point. I know myself, whenever we're done with climbing and you're almost home, you kind of let your guard down. So Chris, thank you so much. I know you have a very busy schedule. I appreciate you coming and sharing your story with us. I mean, it's a great story, and I'm really great that the outcome was positive, and hopefully the patient is doing great right now, so climbing some awesome mountains.
I hope so, and thanks for having me.
Thank you. Hey friends, thanks for listening. June is a busy month on Mount Hood, and PMR has been dispatched to several rescues over the past few weeks. Support from community members like you helps PMR be ready for all missions by offsetting our training costs with your donations. Please consider making a gift today at pmru.org. We really appreciate you. Thank you for listening. We really appreciate you. You can check us out at pmru.org. We are also on Facebook and Instagram under Portland Mountain Rescue, where you can find lots of useful information like current Mount Hood conditions and other public education news. A huge shout out to our editor, Marie Feher, for making us sound good. Until next time, play safe.